Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 7th of January. One of our guests this hour, who is the Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy, says that the escalating war between two arch rivals, Saudi Arabia and Iran, threatened to derail a renewed international bid to halt the conflict in Syria. Here's the latest news today. Iran is accusing Saudi-led coalition battling Shiite rebels in Yemen of hitting its embassy in the capital in an overnight strike. There, of course, has been a dangerous rise in tensions between the two countries. Iran State News Agency said that a Saudi-led airstrike on Wednesday night at the Iranian embassy in Sana'a was very problematic, and we'll talk about that today. That's the latest news. The diplomatic standoff, you could say, I guess, began a long time ago, but on Saturday, Saudi Arabia executed a very popular Shiite cleric and 46 others. The cleric had said that he never advocated violence. But the condemnation of the execution has been fairly widespread. Saudi Arabia severed ties to Iran, and a host of allies have cut or reduced their ties as well. Today, Somalia joined Bahrain and Sudan and entirely cut off diplomatic ties with Iran. So obviously there are many ramifications in an already very troubled part of the world. This adds another layer of troubles, and we'll talk about all of it and the long history of animosity between Saudi Arabia and Iran. We have two guests with us this hour. Dan DeLuce is Foreign Policy's Chief National Security Correspondent, also worked as a reporter for Agence France-Presse, where he was the Pentagon correspondent, and he wrote for The Guardian from Tehran until he was expelled by that regime in 2004. He has reported on the wars in former Yugoslavia for Reuters. Dan, thank you very much for being with us this hour, and hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. Also joining us is Mohammed Bazzi, Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University. He teaches international reporting and was an adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, Middle East Bureau Chief at Newsday, and the lead writer on the Iraq War and its aftermath. He's written about Sunni-Shiite conflicts, militant Islam, and covered the 2000 Palestinian uprising and the war in Afghanistan. Mohammed, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It really would appear that this escalation, obviously the animosity between the two countries has been longstanding, but a lot has been going on since Saturday, hasn't it, Dan?
Yes, you're right. Yes, there were tensions, but this has gotten much worse. And I think the trigger for this was this execution of a very prominent Shiite cleric, Nimr al-Nimr, who is based in eastern Saudi Arabia and has become an activist and leader of the Shiite minority in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been in prison since 2012 for his essentially political dissent. And when the regime announced that it was executing dozens of people they accused of being terrorists, they also, some of whom had links to al-Qaeda, allegedly, they also executed this cleric. And this was an explosive move to make. It was something that Western governments, including the United States, had asked them not to go ahead with. And the European governments actually publicly warned the Saudis not to do this. And it was not a surprise that that execution provoked a tremendous reaction worldwide, but particularly in Shiite Iran, which saw this as just a totally outrageous action. And then things started escalating from there.
Mohammed, why do you think the Saudis went ahead with his execution?
I think initially they had domestic reasons in mind. As Dan pointed out, there were 47 people executed on Saturday. The vast majority, 43 of them, were Sunnis, and most of them were alleged al-Qaeda members, including one particular al-Qaeda ideologue and leader who had been in Saudi prisons for over 10 years. And many of those 43 had been in Saudi prisons since 2004 and 2005, and they were thought to be responsible for a series of attacks inside Saudi Arabia. And it seems that the Saudi regime wanted to balance out the executions. And so they included Sheikh Nimr and three other Shia activists. They were less prominent than him. They haven't gotten as much attention. And so that seemed to shift the attention away from the Saudi regime executing these Sunnis. And they had initially worried that executing these al-Qaeda figures would potentially cause some unrest within the Sunni population in Saudi Arabia. And ultimately, the House of Saud really worries about Sunni anger in Saudi as opposed to Shiite anger. The Shiites are about 10% of the population. And so if the executions had had this impact within the Sunni community, that would have been a threat to the regime. But as it worked out, it immediately became this external issue, and it pulled Iran in with the protests and with the attack on the Saudi embassy in Tehran. And this seems to have worked. The Saudis were able to shift the narrative fairly quickly to Iran and away from the execution of Sheikh Nimr.
Mm-hmm.
Once the embassy was attacked, then that set off that whole series of events of cutting off relations and getting other Saudi allies to cut off relations as well.
And how significant is that, Dan, to have the other allies cut off their relationship with Iran as well?
Well, it intensifies this Sunni Shiite, if you want to call it that, or Saudi Arabia versus Iran sort of cold war. This competition for power and influence, which the Saudis feel very keenly, and those other countries that have joined in with the Saudis, particularly the Gulf countries, view Iran as a threat. Sometimes they see threats for understandable reasons, and sometimes they, I think, overstate the threat posed by Iran sometimes and become self-fulfilling. But nevertheless, there is a very serious power struggle going on across the region. It's symbolic in some ways to withdraw ambassadors or downgrade relations, but to totally cut off diplomatic relations is always a fairly drastic thing to do for a country. Especially at a moment when there is a civil war raging in Syria, and the Saudis and Iran in particular are crucial to trying to end that conflict if it ever is going to end.
And let's talk about that for a moment. I'm not sure what happened with these possible negotiations, Mohammed, but there were to be UN talks in Riyadh on Monday to pave way for negotiations in Geneva. Did those happen?
You mean talks on this past Monday?
Yes.
The UN special advisor went to Riyadh, and he's supposed to go to Tehran soon. We haven't seen very much about that. It got overtaken by so many other events. I think the next key moment is January 15th, when these talks are supposed to resume in Geneva, and where all the players are supposed to sit around the table and begin these negotiations. There are already many obstacles to this, including who would represent the Syrian opposition and whether the Assad regime in Syria would accept those representatives. That was before all of this. It took the United States and Russia a tremendous amount of energy to get the Saudis and the Iranians basically to sit across from each other in the last round of meetings in December. And now the Saudis have said that they're not going to boycott the talks in late January. But if they refuse to talk to the Iranians directly, or if they refuse to sit in the same room together, that's just going to make these talks so much more difficult.
Do you think they will sit at the same table, Dan?
That's a good question. I think we'll have to see. I think it's possible, if there are others at the table, that they might. As Mohammed just pointed out, the Saudis have tried to say, have said since this weekend, they've said this week, you know, yes, we are very angry about what Iran has done, and we're going to stick by this decision to cut off diplomatic ties. But they said, we remain committed to this, very fragile peace process that's trying to be launched. And so they've basically tried to send a signal, we're not going to, sabotage this diplomatic effort. We're not going to withdraw from it. But on the other hand, it was difficult anyway. And after something like this, after the execution of that cleric, and the rhetoric that's flying around, it poisons in many ways the climate for diplomacy. And I think the Americans and the Europeans were particularly angry at the timing. Not only obviously appalled that the cleric was executed, but that the timing of it was so damaging. It was literally right as this UN envoy, who's mediating, trying to mediate an end to the conflict, is headed towards Riyadh, flying to Riyadh, and then was due to go to Tehran this week, and this all happens literally days before that.
Right.
And so it didn't seem like an accident to some people in the U.S. administration.
Mm-hmm. Mohammed, are we to see this as an escalating Sunni-Shia battle, or is there something else at play?
I think it's incomplete to see it as a Sunni-Shia battle and to see it purely in the terms of the historical kind of Sunni-Shia schism within Islam. On the ground, it's mainly a struggle for political dominance of the Middle East between Iran and Saudi. It does take on sectarian dimensions, and both of those powers, both Iran and Saudi, use sectarianism. They instigate sectarianism in various places. They use it to support and whip up their proxies. And what ends up happening is that once those sectarian forces are unleashed, they can't be controlled. Once they're on the ground, and this is what we saw happen in Iraq over the past decade. So sectarianism is a tool that both regimes use, and then they lose control of it. And that's where it gets complicated. I don't think we can purely blame it on a kind of an ancient hatreds understanding that the Sunnis and Shia will just never get along. There were many centuries sort of throughout Islamic history when they did get along to a large extent. I mean, there were internal battles in the Muslim world for a long time. Some of those were Sunni versus Shia. Others were not. Others were Sunni versus Sunni, or Shia faction versus other Shia factions. So I think that's the way we should look at it.
Do you agree, Dan?
I do. I do. I think it's very much. I don't. I think it's too simple. It's shorthand, and journalists like myself have to use shorthand. But it is too simple to say it's Shiite versus Sunni. In many ways, it really is a power struggle between these two countries.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these countries see it as a zero-sum game. Certainly the Saudis do. They don't see, the Saudis can't accept the idea that there would be a coexistence between the Saudi kingdom, a powerful Sunni kingdom and Sunni kind of allies, with Iran as also playing a very powerful role in the region at the same time. They see Iran as this mortal enemy. They see Iran behind many threats, real and imagined. And in many ways, it's almost like the Saudis are trying to turn the clock back. They would like to go back to a time when there was no U.S. or Western diplomacy with Iran, when sanctions would remain on Iran indefinitely, that the Saudis were the preeminent Sunni power in the region, and the Americans were the sort of security guarantor. And there's a frustration that in Riyadh that the ground is shifting.
Mm-hmm.
That you now have foreign ministers in Europe and Washington who regularly speak to the Iranian foreign minister. You have the possibility of Iran maybe, possibly, potentially someday kind of reintegrating into the international community. This nuclear agreement might, open the way to some new era where Iran is no longer this kind of isolated state. So But then again, just to, one more thing. Obviously, though, as Muhammad said, religion plays into it, and religious identity plays into this. So when the Saudis and the Iranians clash like this, then other Shia Sunni countries find themselves gravitating to one or the other power.
Mm-hmm.
So we see this playing out. And then, of course, an example where you see it playing out in real time is Iraq and Syria. So the Shiite-led government in Baghdad is caught between this Shiite partner, Iran, next door, which they cannot possibly ignore, and then the Americans, who arm their forces and carry out airstrikes against their enemies in the Islamic State. So this power struggle plays through every single conflict in the region, and it's also, I think, exploded because there are power vacuums. So the Arab Spring or the Arab turmoil, in which the regimes collapsed or became fragile, opened up this kind of opportunity where both sides, the Saudis and the Iranians, are trying to exert influence. So
mm-hmm.
there's this chaos and civil war in Syria. Yet the regime in Yemen is collapsed. Iraq is very volatile. So these are openings where there's this huge vacuum, and there's both sides are trying to, get the upper hand, and the Saudis fear that the Iranian influence is expanding.
Which is, we did a show, Mohammed, on Prime Minister Netanyahu earlier this week, who was featured on the Frontline PBS show on Tuesday, I believe. It's interesting when I read about what you say, what you have written about Saudi Arabia's concerns about Iran, it struck me that Israel was saying much the same thing.
Yes, we've seen over the past 2 years in the region, we've actually seen the Israeli position and the Saudi position and the position of many of the Sunni states in the Gulf. Those positions got a lot closer, and really since the Iraq invasion, the Saudis have been most concerned with Iran. We've seen that over a number of years. Let's remember the period about 5 years ago when WikiLeaks disclosed all of those cables, and they showed these meetings between Saudi officials and U.S. officials going on in 2005 through 2007, 2008, and where the Saudis and Emiratis and others were urging the U.S. to take action, to take military action against Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And that this poisoned relations in so many ways. I mean, the Iranians read those, and other people in the region read those cables and saw those meetings, and they began to see the level of that threat. Let me add one other point on the rivalry. Some of this is also very religiously symbolic. The House of Saud really rests its legitimacy on this claim that it has leadership over the wider Muslim world, because the kingdom, Saudi Arabia, is home to Islam's two holiest cities, Mecca and Medina. The new king, Salman, has taken on the title of the custodian of the two holy mosques, as previous kings have done. And so for a long time, Saudi Arabia has seen itself as leader of not just the Arab world, but of the wider Muslim world. And even though really Arabs have been the minority within Islam for centuries now, and they don't like this challenge from Iran, which they've seen as a challenge since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, they see Iran trying to challenge them for leadership not of the Shiite world, the much smaller Shiite world, but of the entire Muslim world.
Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests. We have two guests talking about, which is maybe not hard to believe, but tensions are going up even higher in the Middle East as Saudi Arabia has called for severing diplomatic ties with Iran, and other of their allies have done the same. And then we had news that took place overnight, Iran accusing a Saudi-led coalition of hitting its embassy in Yemen in an overnight airstrike. So we have a really dangerous rise in tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And put this in the context of what's supposed to be happening now, which is getting all these opposing forces who are supporting different sides in Syria to a table so that they can work out a solution for peace. It's hard to imagine all of these people sitting at the same table and coming up with something when you don't even have diplomatic relations with some of the key players here. We have two guests with us, and they'll be welcoming your phone calls. Dan DeLuce is Foreign Policy's Chief National Security Correspondent. Mohammed Bazzi, Associate Professor of Journalism at NYU, where he teaches international reporting, and he's done a great deal of reporting from the Middle East. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls now as we look at what's going on in the Middle East, particularly with Saudi Arabia and Iran. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Jake in Oshkosh is our first caller. Gentlemen, hi, Jake.
Hi, good afternoon. I've been listening to your program, and I've often been wondering, what your guests would think about this idea? What would happen in the Middle East if the United States decided to withdraw militarily completely from the Middle East, withdraw arms, withdraw personnel, withdraw money, just do a complete military withdrawal from the Middle East? What do they think would happen in the Middle East?
Dan, you want to start?
That's an interesting question. I think people have posed that a lot recently. I can't predict that. I think, as it pertains to this particular contest, this competition and rivalry between the Saudis and Iran, in a way, the U.S. factor is secondary. This conflict and tension between the Saudis and the Iranians has a very long history, and even before the revolution of 1979 in Iran. When the Shah was in power, and it was a very pro-U.S. Regime, there were conflicts between Iran and the Saudis and Gulf countries. But, I mean, I think the U.S. Has scaled back its role in the region in relative terms compared to where it was in the past, partly by choice. And events have partly forced that, I think you could argue. So I'm not sure that sometimes we ascribe too much importance to what the United States does or doesn't do. And the fact of the matter is that in terms of the Saudis, the U.S. has not had a very successful time always persuading the Saudis to follow a certain course of action. It's always been a rather uneasy relationship on both sides, and there's a huge amount of frustration now. So you could make an argument that the Americans don't get a lot out of the military and other, mainly military support that it provides the Saudis, given how the Saudis are kind of going striking out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, the Saudis have, on their own, decided to stage a major military intervention in Yemen next door against the Houthi rebels there. And they've decided to draw a line, and they've accused Iran of helping the Shiite Houthis there. And that's a case where the United States was not enthusiastic about that, but is not willing to really say that publicly. But the Americans are privately urging the Saudis to stop, but the Saudis keep pushing ahead on that, despite airstrikes that are causing tremendous civilian casualties.
Hmm.
And then in terms of Iran, of course, the United States has had no presence in Iran since the revolution and the seizure of the American embassy way back when. And now, for the first time, with this nuclear agreement, there is some kind of a diplomatic opening now. It's still a very fraught relationship, But there, one thing Obama has tried to pursue is some way to diffuse tensions with Iran. So that was a case where they've pursued a kind of diplomatic approach to try to shift the dynamic between the United States and Iran and between Iran and the rest of the world. But by doing that, they've angered and frustrated and caused a lot of fear and insecurity among the sort of traditional Arab allies. So, and the United States, of course, has this very intense alliance with Israel. And it would be an interesting thought experiment to say, what if the United States withdrew? But we seem to be fairly deep into some of these relationships. I can't imagine the United States withdrawing from its alliance with Israel, for example, for just merely for domestic political reasons, setting aside other considerations. But I think what you do see is Obama has been criticized and accused of withdrawing from the region. The Saudis and the Gulf countries actually use that phrase. And of course, Republican critics have accused Obama of not showing sufficient leadership in the region. But I think the administration will argue that events have their own forces and factors that drive them, and everything is not in the power of the United States to shape.
Mm-hmm. Mohammed, what do you think would happen if we left?
Well, I think the question seems to be beyond just leaving, because the U.S. military presence in the region is much smaller than it was a decade ago, with the withdrawal of most troops from Iraq. And I think the most interesting part of that question was if the U.S. would stop supplying weapons, stop selling weapons to countries in the region, Saudi and others, the Emirates especially, and basically all the countries in the Gulf. And that's an interesting question, because that would change some of the balance in the region, although what would probably happen is Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and Kuwait and others would go to Europe. They would go to France and Germany and Great Britain, and they would buy weapons from there. So I'm not sure. Then in the end, it may not change very much. The Obama administration is often in a bind, because it does get accused of either doing too much or doing too little. I mean, you have the Saudis wanted U.S. military intervention in Syria. They didn't want it in other places. And then they've taken it upon themselves to do this work, certainly in Yemen, in Syria to an extent, by supporting various rebel factions. And so the U.S. does get criticized for doing too much or doing too little.
Mm-hmm. Here's a Facebook message to both of you. Feltz writes to us, "Every time I see this Mideast turmoil, I want to go and ask the people I know who voted for George W. Bush and ask, why did they do it? Do previous presidential administrations bear some responsibility for the current state of conflict in the region?" Dan?
Again, a very interesting question, very broad, difficult to answer. Could have and would have. Certainly, I think there is a pretty, maybe not a consensus, but as time goes on, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was on many levels a fiasco. It did not turn out the way the Bush administration hoped or expected. It did not turn out the way some of U.S. allies like Israel expected. It did not turn out the way some Iraqi opposition activists hoped. And it created a huge vacuum, and it actually strengthened Iran's hand in the region. I don't know if we can blame everything on that war and on how the previous administration handled the Middle East. The Arab Spring occurred on its own merits. Everything can't be traced back to Washington's mistakes or successes, and the region was ripe for implosion. There are a lot of autocratic, brittle regimes, undemocratic, and unresponsive to their populations. And so you saw turmoil sweeping Egypt and Tunisia, and then in Syria. And so I'm not sure you can blame the civil war necessarily on whatever actions the U.S. took or didn't take. Mm-hmm. I think that's, for me, I think that is important to point out, that this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is playing out in a way where the U.S. is somewhat of a bystander. Some of what the U.S. does is very important, but in many ways, both of those countries have interests and believe they have interests that are at odds, and they're in an intense rivalry, and I'm not sure what the U.S. could do to stop that.
Mm-hmm. Mohammed, do you think we stirred things up significantly by invading Iraq?
Invading Iraq did change the region in ways that certainly the Bush administration didn't expect. It did stir things up. It did make Iraq the initial central arena of this proxy battle between the Saudis and the Iranians. And we should step back for a moment and think that both Iran and Saudi have legitimate national security interests in Iraq. They were both, especially the Iranians, they were both the victims of the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein. For a long time, the Saudis supported Saddam in his war against Iran. Iran suffered the most under Saddam's regime. That was a terrible 8-year war and a million people killed on both sides. And so when we wonder why Iran got so heavily involved in Iraq, it had, in its mind, it had a interests, and the major interest was to prevent Iraq from ever threatening Iran again. And the counter to that was the Saudis always saw Iraq as this counterbalance, as this bulwark against Shiism spreading from Iran, you know, whether or not that's legitimate, whether or not they actually would have done that. But Iraq is a majority Shia country. It was ruled by a Sunni for a long time. A terrible dictatorial regime, and that regime did help those other Gulf countries. It helped contain Iran. It helped box it into this war all through the 80s. And then the Saudis realized after the U.S. invasion that now Iraq would be dominated by the Shiites, would be dominated by that majority, and so they got heavily involved. And you know, could the Bush administration have foreseen that? There were people at the State Department. There were long reports and analysis written ahead of the invasion that pointed some of this out. And you know, it's very hard to do the do-over, and it's very hard to speculate what would have happened had. You know, I agree with Dan that the Arab uprisings in 2011 would have probably happened on their own. They might have happened earlier, even if the United States had not been in Iraq. Would the course of events have been different? Maybe. But we have to deal with the hand we've been dealt right now.
Let's go to Rich next in Appleton. Hi, Rich.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you for the show, and thank you for your guest being there. I guess I'm looking at a little bit of maybe naivety on the Americans' behalf. Can either one of your guests or possibly both of them give us maybe a little bit of history of how the Western, or how they feel the Western influence over the course of time, Britain and whoever else was in there, affected that? And one of the main things I'm interested in is the oil. Did the Rockefellers, just to use one of the big oil names, go there in the 1800s, 1900s, and just kind of enslave their people to take the oil? Did we create stuff even back that far? So I guess I would be interested in a little bit of history, if possible.
All right, Dan, take it.
I'll try.
Okay.
I mean, yes, oil is at the heart of a lot of this. First of all, the Saudis made a strategic decision to, once oil was discovered there, and it was Standard Oil, at the time, to go with the Americans, not to go with British or European oil companies. Because unlike the Europeans, the Americans did not have a colonial legacy in the Middle East. So that was kind of how this very unusual, strange relationship, unlikely, I guess, alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia started, and it was something Franklin Roosevelt launched. And then, it carried on over time through the Cold War. There was a common interest in countering the Soviets. The Saudis eventually took over their oil assets. So there is not a perception, I don't think now, that the Americans are repressing or responsible for some kind of colonial repression, past or present. But the oil is at the heart of the relationship, and right now the Saudis are feeling a real pinch. As you know, the oil prices have plunged to a dramatic degree, under $35 a barrel, which is extraordinary. And it's created all sorts of economic effects all over the world, and in Saudi Arabia, a country where you don't think of having a budget deficit, and they have a budget deficit, and it's a problem. And it's created real financial pressures. So, and then, of course, the oil price being so low has caused an even bigger problem for the Iranians. They have less reserves, and they're even more dependent on oil in some ways. And they have suffered under these sanctions that were imposed over their nuclear program. And those sanctions, including on various frozen assets, but also on their ability to export oil, those are going to be lifted soon. And Iran then will then be able to export oil and make more money. But the problem is the oil price is low. So it's causing economic problems for all the oil-rich countries. And then in terms of the colonial hangover, I would say that, the Iranians feel the colonial heritage in a very acute way. Iran, through late 1800s and the 20th century, suffered under the hand of colonial dominance from the British in particular, their view is. And of course, there was a coup in 1953, and the democratically elected leader at the time in Iran was ousted by a coup that was orchestrated by the British intelligence and the CIA, and the Iranians have not forgotten that. And the regime, the current regime, still cites that event, and that was about oil. That at the time, the British had oil interests there and did not want the Iranian government to be nationalizing the oil assets. So, yes, there is a hangover from Western colonial power being exerted.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the history, it's almost as if the awkward alliance between the Americans and the Saudis is beginning to lose momentum. The Soviets are gone. And now Iran might be, this is still early days and it may not play out, but one scenario is Iran takes a more pragmatic path, less confrontational. That is a possibility. I think it may seem fanciful to some people, but the Saudis worry that the Americans are basically going to drop them, that the Americans don't need mm-hmm. us anymore. Oil prices are low. The Iranians are being friendly, more friendly now with Washington. This is their kind of fear.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. I want to go back to the execution of Cleric Al-Nimr last Saturday and find out a little bit more about his criticism of the royal family and the response on the part of some Shia in Saudi Arabia. Could this be a growing problem for the royal family, too, to the Shia minority in Saudi Arabia? And also, I read that the United States privately expressed concern about an execution. Could the United States had been more vociferous in their concerns about such an execution, or are they trying to be diplomatic here in some way? And we'll welcome more phone calls. We have two guests with us this hour. They are Dan DeLuce, Foreign Policy's Chief National Security Correspondent, Mohammed Bazzi, Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University. Both gentlemen have done extensive reporting from the Middle East. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If we could for a moment just go back to the execution that took place last Saturday, I'm wondering about the Shia response, the supporters of al-Nimr, who I guess the funeral was supposed to be this afternoon. Are we seeing more of a revolt against the royal family on the part of a Shia minority? Will we see more of that as a result of the execution, Mohammed?
We've seen some protests since news of the execution on Saturday, protests mostly in the eastern province, which is where most of the Shia of Saudi Arabia live. It also happens to be where most of the oil is located. We haven't seen any large-scale demonstrations, and part of that is because of the clampdown and because of the message that was sent by the executions themselves. There were larger protests in the Shia communities in Saudi Arabia in 2001, and that was one of the main reasons that the Saudi regime ended up arresting Sheikh Nimr in 2012 because of his actions in helping instigate those protests in 2011, right after the revolution in Egypt, and also as protests began in Bahrain. So the protests haven't reached the levels that we saw in 2011, 2012, and there were also a spate of protests in 2014 after the death sentence was handed down against Sheikh Nimr. Will we see an internal Shiite revolt against the House of Saud? I think that's unlikely, and that's mostly because of numbers. The Shiites just aren't, that community isn't large enough to seriously threaten the ruling family in Saudi Arabia. We're talking about 10% of the population out of their 20 million Saudi citizens. 10% of them are Shiite. You have another 8 million foreign workers in Saudi Arabia, but they're mostly on the sidelines because they live there at the whim of the regime. So it's not, I don't think the threat, the more serious threat to the Saudi royal family comes from Sunni hardliners. It comes from the other side. It actually comes from people who are more hardline in their interpretation of Sunni Islam than the royal family. And that's the danger they're always worried about. And one of the things we've seen over the past 6 months is more activity by ISIS inside the kingdom. There were several bombings over the summer of Shiite mosques. We had three bombings at one point of Shiite mosques carried out by suicide bombers from ISIS. And then in the fall, there was a bombing at a security headquarters that killed something like 14 members of the security forces. And that really alarmed the Saudi regime. So that's the more serious internal threat to the House of Saud.
And let's go back to Syria for a moment, Dan, if you don't mind. I'm interested in, as we try to figure out who would be a viable alternative to Assad in Syria, the United States trying to figure that out, and we're wondering if we're going to see peace negotiations underway. I'm wondering about Saudi Arabia sending money and weapons to the rebels in Syria. Who exactly are they supporting? What rebels?
Well, they're supporting a range of rebel groups. They come in many stripes and shapes and sizes, and they are supporting some rebel elements that the United States feels are far too hard line. And so there's a argument about which rebels deserve to be supported, which rebels should be represented at peace talks, which rebels would actually be, part of some kind of political transition. And this is also part of the tension between the United States and Saudi Arabia. That's a reflection of that. because in many ways, Saudi Arabia, with its very sort of hardline interpretation of Islam, or it promotes a pretty inflammatory interpretation of Islam that is ends up becoming commingled with ideology that fuels extremists like Al Qaeda, and so it's another. You know, this came up after 9/11 that Saudi Arabia had actually. Either the government or individuals in Saudi Arabia had helped, kind of feed this kind of extreme ideology and interpretation of Sunni Islam. But in terms of Syria, the Saudis see themselves as the patrons of all opponents of the Assad regime. And they don't want to see whatever political settlement might be proposed. I don't think the Saudis or the rebels they're supporting would be willing to accept the idea of a kind of a facade where Assad stepped down, perhaps, but one of his minions took over, some kind of Alawite general, or some kind of halfway solution that did not spell the complete end of that regime, and that's why the peace talks are at the moment, possibly doomed until the war rages on further and there's a clear victor.
Mm-hmm. Mohammed, what do you think the U.S. should do in terms of applying pressure to Saudi Arabia, to Iran? What can we do to further, which would be in everybody's best interest, in end of the fighting in Syria? Are we any kind of effective force now in negotiation?
I mean, at this point, we're a weakened force in negotiations, especially on Syria, partly because the Russians have taken such a leading role now in bombing and in having this extensive support for Assad. The conventional wisdom is that the Russians aren't as wedded to Assad staying in power as the Iranians are. Really sort of the leverage we as the U.S. have over Iran is now connected to the nuclear deal and to the lifting of sanctions. And certainly many elements in Iran want normalization with the West, whether we're talking about an actual diplomatic relations with Iran, that's coming, that would be much further down the line. But they do want to come back into the international fold, and that's one way of gaining some leverage over Iran. Over Saudi, the leverage can be a little more tangible, especially in the way we supply weapons to the Saudis. We probably have a little more leverage over the Saudis, perhaps in Yemen. And the U.S. hasn't, I don't think it's exerted that leverage as well as it could, because that war is dragged on. It's now becoming quite costly to the Saudis. And it's also connected to this regional dynamic. And we've seen since Saturday, since the execution, the Saudis stepped up airstrikes in Yemen. Today, the reports coming out of the capital, Sana'a, are that it's been one of the most intense bombardments today since the war started in March, so in 9 months. And that's a message from the Saudis of at least for now, as where they plan to go. They're going to intensify and not de-escalate.
Yeah. And on that note, we have to say goodbye to both of you. It's been most informative. We thank you very much for being with us, Dan and Mohammed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dan DeLuce, Foreign Policy's Chief National Security Correspondent, who has reported from Tehran until he was kicked out by the regime in 2004. He's been reporting from Yugoslavia and many other places. Mohammed Bazzi, who's an Associate Professor of Journalism at NYU, and he has reported from, he was the Middle East Bureau Chief for a number of years. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee.